About 90 days later, we received a price increase of $48 million for the year.
Wow.
What does know their pain mean in the context of negotiations?
There's a fallacy in life, Mike, and it's not apparent to everyone, but here's the fallacy. The fallacy is that we present a great amount of intellectual information, and that information, including our compromises and our assumptions, will drive the negotiation.
Or drive to sale?
Drive to sale. Either one. But what's really interesting is that they do not drive a decision. They do not drive a negotiation. They do not drive a sale. What drives a negotiation is vision. Vision of the adversary. Their vision, not ours. Now, that is a major breakthrough when people discover that. Here's something interesting. We are always safe in the other person's world. And when we're dealing with their vision of their pain, their vision of the real challenges they face, and those things are amplified and focused so they're very clear, that vision of pain will drive the negotiation to a successful conclusion for ourselves. But they have to see it, and we have to help them. Hence, we have to be creative and create vision. We can ask questions, or we can make statements to create that vision.
It all goes back to that emotional decision.
Absolutely. And it never changes.
At what point might it be to a consultant's advantages or anyone's advantage to walk away from a negotiation? And how would you know you had arrived there?
It's really very simple. We don't teach walk away. We don't teach brinksmanship. We don't teach manipulative tactics. You won't hear us use words like power or leverage or advantage. Those just aren't valid. What you'll hear from us is mission and purpose. Now, a mission and purpose has some rules, and we use Peter Drucker and his book Innovation and Entrepreneurship as our guiding document. He does a really great job in that book. But we develop mission and purpose based on what we bring to the negotiation. Anytime a negotiation does not move our mission and purpose forward, we abort the negotiation. So up until it goes against our mission and purpose, we continue the negotiation because it fits the mission and purpose. As soon as it doesn't, we stop.
So if a consultant's meeting with a potential prospect and, you know, these consultants want to look for hidden assets in the business, and after he gets done with his interview, if he sees the guy just doesn't have assets and he's a startup and we advise not to even deal with it, you abort it. You say, I'm sorry, I don't think we're going to be a match, and you walk away.
That's right. And it also, in that case, in a negotiation, we have to know what we want. In that case, we want a client that can afford to pay us, that can afford to work with us. So that would also be cause to abort.
Right. Let me ask you this. Why are you against PowerPoint and other presentations in a negotiation?
Because they present intellectual information. See, they're designed to create vision, but in reality, they create intellectual information and objections. Well, see, intellectual information presented is what causes and brings about objections. Now, I know that there are dozens of books and people have made a living teaching people how to deal with objections. I remember 40 years ago, I first heard the term feel, felt, and found. And let me give you an example. My name is Jim Camp, and I work with Phillips Petroleum. And we offer high-grade gasoline at $3.70 a gallon. And you will find our additives to be of the highest quality. So don't you want to buy Phillips gasoline?
No, because you're giving me ideas to object. Well, how do I know they're the highest quality?
There we go.
Michael, I know exactly how you feel. Many people have felt the same way that you feel about the high price of gasoline. But what we found...
So now I've got to deal with what I created. On the other hand, if I just asked you a simple question, what type of fuel do you use in your automobile?
I use unleaded.
Interesting. What quality?
The 89 octane.
Have you ever experimented with a higher octane?
I have not.
Interesting. What's held you back?
I thought that the higher octane was more expensive, but it did the exact same thing, and I can get by on my 89, and I'd rather pay less money.
How many miles can you afford to cut off your engine life?
Well, you know, these gas companies, you know, they're just trying to sucker people into paying the high octane, but it really just is all the same.
I see. So how many miles can you cut off?
I don't know.
Interesting. let's stop here. I just took a subject I have no idea what
I'm talking
about.
Yeah, gotcha. I'm with you, though.
But I'm not creating the objections. We're having a discussion in your world, your engine, et cetera, et cetera.
So, again, questions in listen rather than present.
Exactly. I've never given a PowerPoint in my 40-year career.
No handout?
Nope.
You're just a great listener.
No. I'm a great negotiator, and I have a system, Mike, because I know exactly where I'm going. I've formed my mission and purpose. I know the problems I face, up to and including something as simple as, I have no idea why you even invited me here. And that's the truth. So it's all principle-based, and it overcomes any tactic. If I start using tactics, I'd be in real trouble.
Right. What if I have a meeting with my adversary and he's expecting to hear facts? I mean, there's got to be negotiations and meetings where facts are critical for coming to an agreement. How would you address that?
It's an interesting concept, Mike, and this is a little bit difficult to explain, but I'll do my very best. 99% of the time, people will go to a meeting and just load up the facts and the figures and information to prove their case, much like an attorney would in a court of law. So they go in demonstrating or providing facts and figures and information that provide and prove a case. But all they do is create objections with that. They're literally creating objections, because if they would deal with the information in a questioning way and allow discovery of the other side, they would find they would be much more effective and much more efficient. Now, anytime we set an agenda to go to a meeting, if we set the agenda that we're going to come to the meeting and provide facts and figures, shame on us. We should have a meeting to allow them to describe to us, to allow them to explain to us, to allow them to paint a picture of the challenges of their world. We don't do PowerPoints. I've never done a PowerPoint. For example, let's take a fact. It's a fact that a system of negotiation is effective. If you have a system and anything that solves problems, it's effective. So instead of presenting the facts or the intellectual information of negotiation, instead I'll ask. In a meeting, I'll ask the question, what system of negotiation do you have in place? And they'll fumble around, and I'll ask again. And they usually fumble around, and they try to say, well, you know, we like win-win. I prepare a BATNA, and they struggle through it. And they discover they don't really have a system. So now the discovery is starting to take place. Then you ask another question simply, well, what is the number one principle in negotiation? What is the number one rule? Well, if they don't have a rule or a number one rule, there's more discovery. So what you'll find is once they have that discovery, then they'll ask you, well, what is the number one rule? So now you can give that to them because you've created the vision. They don't know it. They don't have it. And now they can ask the question of you, well, what is the number one rule? And when you give it to them, then you can discuss it.
Okay, so you can give them facts, but after they've asked for it.
After they've asked for it, but you have to create the vision of what the fact does.
I see. And there's also a place for facts and figures after an agreement has been met, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But you see, let's take wearing a seatbelt. There are reams of data on wearing a seatbelt. Yet there are people who poo-poo wearing seatbelts. If you approach them with that data, they'll look at you and say, I know all about that. I don't care about that. So you haven't really accomplished anything. But if you ask the question, when your car collides with another car at 60 miles an hour, where will your body end up?
Yeah, that's visual.
It's visual. Well, what do you mean? Well, where will you end up? Will you be out on the road? Will you be through the windshield cut in half on the hood of the car? I mean, where will you be? It's a whole different perspective. It's a whole different way of approaching decision-making. Because decisions are made with vision, not with intellect. The brain functions in the emotional arena, not the intellectual arena, in decision-making.
Yeah, and that one vision question is much more powerful than all the ream of facts that you can present.
Exactly.
I've let my consultants around the world know that I'd be interviewing you, and since we were unable to do it live, I had some of the consultants send in some questions for you related to their consulting practice.
Sure.
So here's a question from Pete Pareka, D&M Associates. His website is hideassets.com. Mike, here are a few questions. Is it okay to lower your price when your client says it's too much after a presentation? If I say it's $3,500 a step and he says he can only afford $2,500, do I take it and try to get more on the back end after performing?
That would be a conventional strategy based on the tactics he used. Unfortunately, because he didn't know how to set an agenda, the price should never have been a factor. But because he presented it in such a way, he created an objection, what we just talked about. First of all, before I present this, all I ask is if you understand this is going to be expensive. I also would like you to understand that you can say no to me. But because he doesn't know how to set an agenda, unfortunately, he fell into that objection trap.
That's good. The answer you gave would probably fit this question as well. When a client says, how much is it okay to say, how much can you afford, or is it best to have a strict price and stick to it?
Let's talk about that just a moment, because how much does it cost? Let's talk about the ability to create vision. And so what we're looking for is behavior that allows them to discover the value. Okay, so let's talk about that a moment. How much does it cost? That's a great question. It's expensive. It can be very expensive depending on what all's involved. So what have we done? Now, I don't know what expensive means to that person. If he's a chairman or CEO of a Fortune 500 company, expensive could be millions.
So should we go in ahead of time, do some research, find out how much revenue the business is doing, and bring that information into the negotiation?
Well, what we really should do is we should set an agenda, which we just talked about a moment ago, that allows the person to discover the value and the price of what we're offering. I mean, let's get that out there and deal with it, and let's get the problem in place. Here's the problem. This is expensive. What are your thoughts on the expense?
That's good. Here's a couple questions from marketing consultant Paul Flood of Paul Flood Marketing at paulfloodmarketing.com. From a standpoint of negotiating for clients, and now this is when a consultant has a client and he's trying to negotiate better pricing from their vendors to reduce cost, what are some recommended techniques to keep negotiations from becoming antagonistic, since vendors may see us as, quote, the consultant, end quote, who is just out to squeeze out their profits?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, the real problem there is the person that sees himself as just the consultant squeezing out profits. That's not a problem that the vendors have. That's a problem the consultant has. So what has to happen here is, first of all, you know, what's the mission and purpose of the consultant in the negotiation? What are they delivering to this negotiation with the vendor? And so if they see themselves as trying to squeeze profits for their client from the vendor, that's how the vendor's going to see them. It's going to come off in the behavior of the consulting negotiator. And now, I know this is a little bit hazy for everyone, and it's difficult, Mike, to see, but it's really not the vendor's problem. It's the consultant's problem. Now, if the consultant can't get rid of that problem, if they can't dump that and get into the negotiation, then they have to set an agenda that, look, I'm here for a reason. I'm not just here to squeeze you. I'm here to work with you, but more importantly, to help my client. Do you have a problem with that? So that negotiation has to happen first. But I would hope, and I say this, I would hope that the consultant would gain a system of negotiation so that that never has to be brought up.
It keeps going back to you, back to the consultant, back to the confidence, back to his sense of values. It all starts with you.
That's exactly right. And if you don't have a system of negotiation, Mike, I promise you they're going to flounder. That's going to continue. And they're never going to have the breakthrough consulting business they could have.
He asks, what are some of Jim's tips to keep negotiations from becoming emotional?
Unfortunately, there is no tip. There's only the principle of decision-making. And that decision-making, to make a decision, causes the brain to transition to the intellectual to evaluate the decision and reposition for the next decision. So the ability to make effective decisions will drive the motion down. It's almost like a boiling cauldron. I refer to it with my clients as a boiling cauldron of bubbling soap like we used to have on the farm in Pennsylvania, my grandmother's, when they were rendering lye soap. And my job was to keep the fire at a certain level so the soap didn't boil too high or cool and become too low. And emotions are the same way. So we make decisions to ask questions, make statements, sit back in our chair, take notes, to continually manage the emotion, because it is emotional. That's not going away. It's never cool, calm, and collected, it's going to be emotional. Now, you lower that emotion with decision-making. You know, it's interesting, Mike, I tell my clients about the fighter pilots they hear on the radio. Every once in a while, we're privy to a fighter pilot in combat, maybe in Iraq or somewhere, talking on the radio, and they're being shot down or ready to eject. And you can hear, it's not that their voice is totally calm, but they're effective in their decision-making. You hear things like, I've just taken a very big hit. The aircraft is starting to go out of control. I'm going to have to eject. Mayday, 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 and then you hear the whoosh. Well, they weren't in a panic, and their training kicked in, but actually it was decision-making based on that experience they gained through their training and their failing safely earlier in their career. It's the same thing with negotiations and managing a negotiation.
Here's a question from Dave Flannery out of Ireland, and I believe you talked to him for some time.
I did talk to Dave. Yes, I did.
And he had asked, can you go into some detail as to what you mean by the four budgets of a negotiation and how they affect the outcome of a negotiation?
Yes, absolutely. In my book, Start With No, and also in my new book, No, that's coming out in June, we spend a whole chapter in that arena because it's so critical to our performance. Time, if I were to say to the audience, could you give me 5 minutes of time, most of the audience would say, sure. So it appears to not have as much value as some of the other three. So we rank it the first in the negotiation, and we give it an arbitrary value, Mike, of 1x. Let's talk about that for just a moment. When we were children in elementary school, I'm sure the listening audience remember those days, and they would watch the clock go tick, tick, tick. You literally watch the second hand click through the seconds for school to end and the bell to ring. I know I did. It seemed like time was just dragging by, and we couldn't wait for the weekend, or we couldn't wait for the holidays, we couldn't wait for summer break, we couldn't wait to be 16 and drive a car. Now I'm a grandfather, and there's not enough hours in the day. So it varies by individual, so we give it an X. It has a value of 1x. Time is easily given away, but it varies in value for the individual.
I got it.
Same with energy. Now, I've been fortunate all my life. I've always been a high-energy person. So I could go 24 hours without sleep and keep right on ticking, and I've had to do that in the past. And in some pretty duress situations back in the Vietnam War. But we all have a feeling of energy, and it has a value, again, of X. But we put 2X on it. Now, if we put time and energy into a negotiation, 2 times 1 is 2. So now the negotiation brings on a value of 2X. Now, if we throw in money, again, it depends on the individual and what money really means to them. A dollar might mean to one person what $1,000 means to another. So we have a value of 3X. But you'll notice when we throw money in with our time and energy and we invest money, we now have a value of 6X. It's growing exponentially. Now, when we blend in the emotion, the excitement and expectation, which we teach not to have, with the fear and the pain that comes with failing, and we blend that in, again, it's all different for us, it has a value of 4X. 6 times 4 is 24X. We have to manage our budget in the negotiation and be aware of those four ingredients.
Can you go into a little bit more detail on these budgets? It's still a little hazy to me.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. Budget is very simple, the price that is being paid by the parties in a negotiation. Everybody's investing time. Now, time has a different value for each person. The younger the person is, the easier time is spent. Time's not as valuable to some people as it is to others. The older we get, oftentimes the more valuable time becomes. Or the busier we are, the more valuable our time. So time has a value of 1X. And the second price paid in a negotiation, the second part of the budget, is energy. The amount of energy expended in a negotiation is a critical factor. And in fact, many times you'll find energy really sneaks up on people in negotiations. When you become tired, you'll hear things like, let's cut to the chase. Let's just get this over with. Let's just move on. And that energy that we're spending slips in there, and pretty soon it starts affecting our thought process and it starts dragging on us emotionally, and we compromise easier and give up easier than we should. The third part is money. When you invest money in negotiation, the value increases exponentially. So let's just recap here for a second. Time is 1X, one unknown value. Energy is 2X. So 2 times 1 is 2. So the value of the negotiation, when you just have time and energy involved, is 2x. When you add money, money is a 3x. So 3 times 2 now makes it 6x. Now here's the killer. When you add emotional excitement of success or the emotional fear of failing, you add a quantity of 4x. So 4x times 6x is 24x, and that's when you have a full budget in the negotiation.
So let's use a little example. Let's say that you're in a civil lawsuit and you got a guy who owes you $1,000 and you want to negotiate to get him to pay you that $1,000 that he owes you. And he hasn't invested any time. He's got your money. And then you're performing the negotiation with him. So let's say you hire an attorney and you file in small claims court and the sheriff comes over there and knocks on his door and serves him the lawsuit. Right there, we're upping the ante with emotion and time to litigate. And money, the potential cost to litigate, these elements are going to increase his budget in this negotiation, or is it increase my budget to help resolve this?
No, it will increase his budget. You're right. You're going to have the emotional document. The sheriff standing at the door is pretty scary to a lot of people. God, what's he doing here? So there's emotion being added. There's energy. He has to take the paper, he has to look at it, he has to think about it. Is he going to hire an attorney? Maybe he's going to spend some money. Does he have to take the time to travel to the courthouse? So all of those things will add to his budget. A good example, a lot of times I'll ask my clients to drive the budget. And here's what I mean by that. Let's invite them to travel to see us. We do a lot of international coaching and work all over the world, and I'll ask my clients to say, rather than you flying to the mainland of China, why don't you invite them to San Francisco from Beijing? Why don't they have to travel to you for the meeting? And that will drive their budget. They're investing time, energy, money, and emotion.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'll give you a perfect example. I've got a guy who's got a published book. He wants to meet me. He's here in San Diego. He wants me to meet him on the water, which is going to take more time out of my Friday. And I emailed him and said, I can't meet you on the water. Why don't you come up right here by me, which is just a minute from my home? And so I'm going to make him come up here and meet me for lunch at my location.
Yeah, exactly. So you're going to drive his budget.
Okay, that's good. Now, these examples help me understand that. Did you come up with this?
Yes, I did.
And it can also show you the windfalls when you're doing it properly.
It absolutely does. And we want to be sure that the other party has a full budget in the negotiation.
That's great. Roger Dawson, Herb Cohen, Krauss. Did you ever study these guys' material?
Only as long as I could afford to fail.
How did it all start for you? I mean, why are you doing this now? How did you end up in this entire realm of negotiation? Did you have some poor negotiating experiences when you were younger or earlier in your career?
I've been blessed, and I know a lot of people say that, I've been blessed all my life to be around some great people and some very effective decision makers. I had told you about my father, I believe, earlier in the discussion, and about the governor of Ohio and Coach Hayes at Ohio State. And my grandfather ran a steel mill for 43 years in Pennsylvania, came to this country from England. So I've been around some pretty great men who were pretty effective in their decision making. So I was blessed with that kind of background. But I had some real challenges. I started studying when I was about 22 years old to leave the military and started studying some of these conventional wisdom type folks. And what I discovered was, as I tried to apply what they were teaching, they were very, very helpful in a lot of ways. Please don't misunderstand this, but when it came to really moving up in the world, you don't close a deal with the chairman of a board. You don't close a deal. The chairman discovers he would like to move it forward. So you don't close deals. The things they teach sound good and they're interesting, but at the end of the day, they don't work.
For more interviews like this, please go to hardtofindseminars.com.
Not when you really move into the bigger games. So I had to adjust or fall by the wayside. So I adjusted.
Were you selling something using these older techniques?
I was. I was selling water softeners. This was just working for a water softener company in Goleta, California.
And you were doing direct outside sales?
Yeah, I went door to door and talked with homemakers, and they had terrible water, Mike. Oh, boy. And I was failing miserably. And I was excited, and I was saying all the right things, I thought. Man, I was the greatest objection dealer in the world.
Yeah.
And people wouldn't even open their door for me. I mean, it was like I had to talk through the crack of the door. And finally, you know, I just kind of threw it out and said, I don't know if you need help with your water or not. How happy are you with the way water treats your hair? And people started opening doors.
Really?
I mean, it was that simple. I got into their world, asked a question. One thing led to another, but because I was around great people, I literally had some really great people say to me, okay, Cam, keep your mouth shut. Just don't embarrass me here.
What do you mean by that?
You know, these typical conventional things that were being taught and still being taught are exciting and they're fun. You know, be excited, be enthusiastic, have that positive expectation. Get you killed. And some of the really great people I was working with said, don't embarrass me. Be quiet, I'll do the talking. And I would hear someone worth a couple $1 million, look at someone and say, look, I'm not sure this even fits. Now, I didn't understand why they were saying that. Then the conversation would move to, well, what do you think? How does it work? And one thing led to another, and pretty soon we had some pretty amazing successes in the business world. And I loved negotiation. And the coup de grace for me was I had expanded to 24 states, and I had a great board of directors.
Was this still with the water softeners?
No. This is long after that. I was raising funds for high schools, and I was offering students peanuts to sell.
You got a sales background.
Oh, yeah. I had a sales background and a real estate background.
Okay.
I bought and sold real estate.
All right.
And done a lot of things, to be real honest here. But
so in an effort to become better, to sell better, to be more effective, this is where your thirst for learning how to do that came to be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then finally, Coach Hayes said to me one day, he said to me, Jim, you've got to read the classics. You've got to study the great minds and the great thinkers. You're a driven person, and you cannot go through this life without studying the great minds and classics. So I started studying, literally, and I read Emerson's essay on compensation. I read Emerson's essay on self-reliance. I read William Manchester's The Last Lion. And 187 volumes of great thinkers later, it all started coming to me. And so we use examples throughout our training. We didn't invent anything, Mike. And I had great, great scholars advising me. So going back to the question, hey, I love Zig Ziglar to listen to him. He's very entertaining. I love the way he talks. But you couldn't do that in the boardroom where I am today. If I used those tricks or tactics he teaches, I'd be thrown out. I wouldn't be invited back. You can't get there with that.
Right, not today you can't.
No, the only person that can get there is the person that's on stage teaching it. Because they don't behave that way when they go behind closed doors with real players.
What are some other classics you can throw out there as recommended reading for some of these consultants?
Oh, my goodness. Drucker. Read everything Drucker's ever written. It's wonderful. Read everything you can get by Stephen Ambrose on history of World War II, the Lewis and Clark expedition on the railroads, and Lincoln. Read everything you can get your hands on Lincoln. On the Gettysburg Address, read Wills. Read anything you can get your hands on that is fun to read about Socrates. Study those types of people. Study Emerson. Study Thomas Edison. Study those kinds of people. Study the great generals. Study MacArthur and Patton. Study the great presidents. Read everything you can get on great people and their biographies. Anything that drives effective decision-making. That's really the key ingredient. We have 187 volumes we recommend to all of our clients to support reading for our training.
Can we talk about some war stories? What's one of the biggest negotiating mistakes you made in your career?
Oh, boy. I've made so many. I think probably the biggest one I made was with my father when I wanted to borrow $80,000 to buy the state of California for Wendy's.
What happened?
It was 1971, and I was with Coach Hayes at lunch with Dave Thomas at the Yankee dealership in Columbus, Ohio. And Dave Thomas told me if I put together $80,000, he would sell the franchise for the state of California to me for Wendy's hamburgers. And he would help me get Wendy's started in California. And I went to my father to negotiate to borrow $80,000 because I was in the military, didn't have two nickels to rub together. And my father was absolutely convinced that there was no future in hamburgers, that because of the Burger Boy Foodorama and the Burger King and Sandy's hamburgers and McDonald's hamburgers and all these other chains, Wendy's didn't have a chance.
And you didn't have the skills to sell them.
I didn't have the skill. I didn't have the fortitude to go to the banks or to anyone else or to bring a group of people together. I was still in the military looking to be discharged. It just wasn't going to happen. That's probably my greatest failure. That did sell for $53 million a few years later.
Well, I hope it doesn't eat you up too much.
Oh, it doesn't.
You got some good stuff going. Any client success stories that you can talk about, of great stories that the consultants could relate to that maybe teach some kind of lesson in negotiation, just a great success story?
Quite frankly, in the book, we probably have 500. They're not believable, to be quite honest with you. For example, Intel is probably the greatest adversary in the world of negotiation. They're a very difficult organization to negotiate with. And we've had more than 30 contracts at full price with arguably the toughest negotiator in the high-tech world. So there's reasons for that. But that's probably the greatest success story, though. We've got a lot like that.
Can you give me another story, something
sure.
like that?
Sure.
Go ahead.
What we've found in this situation is that it involved a warranty on a product. And my client had paid the warranty replacement cost, and the bill was clear and paid for. But the other side of the table demanded a $4 million surcharge to cover the replacement of the warranty products, which was not in the contract. And what they said was that if you don't give us the $4 million, then we're going to hold all orders from you. And that was a considerable income, you know, in the $40, $50 million range. So what we did is we began negotiating and elevating the negotiation. And when the leadership found out that the purchasing group was trying to extort the $4 million from my client, the purchasing group was relieved of their duties, literally relieved, and left the organization. And my client was given a $190 million contract.
Wow. How long did that whole negotiation take?
A year and a half.
So some of these negotiations can really take years sometimes.
The more complexity, the more individuals involved, Mike, the longer they can take.
Okay. How about one more for the listeners?
I had a client who was approached to do some consulting, and they were questioned about their consulting. And the person who had requested the consulting could not make the decision. So I coached the consultant to approach the CEO of the organization, the chief executive officer. And by negotiating with the chief executive officer, eventually the consulting fees for that engagement were over $380,000, which was his largest contract.
That's excellent. Are you worried that your adversaries will read your books and learn your system and all of your secrets?
No, because they can't get by themselves. Now, that doesn't mean that people won't begin to catch on, which is what I want to have happen. My mission and purpose is truly to help the world become more effective in decision-making. Here's the problem. The problem is people will read the book and they'll find that takes away the personal ego. I didn't invent this, neither did they. There are no tricks or tactics to celebrate. So because there's no tricks or tactics that, quote, they invented, it's just sound principled thought and the laws of human behavior, I can't claim ownership. I can only claim to introduce it or to arrange it in such a way that you can swallow it. Have you ever sat around in a sales group or someone, what the world calls a rainmaker, and they love to swap stories about how smart they are and how they closed this deal and how they closed that deal and I got them on this one and I got them on that one?
It's ego-driven.
It's all ego-driven. And if they can't get past their ego, then they're not going to get it. In fact, they're going to reject it and attack it because they want to protect their smartness and they want to protect their intelligence, which all boils down to emotion and ego. And that has no interest to me.
What part of the method do you find your students have the most difficulty learning? What are some of the most difficult habits to break in order to master the CAMP system?
Thinking. They think they know the answer. So therefore, they make assumptions. And when they make assumptions, it drives their emotional fear to fall back to compromise to at least get something out of it. So they think they know what the person's going to say. They think they know what the person's going to believe. They think they know what the person's going to do. You know, think about it, Mike. People go to Las Vegas because they think they're going to win the money. They go to Las Vegas to gamble because they think it's their lucky day. So that thought process, that being the smartest person on the block, that being the quickest, the slickest, the smartest, the trickiest, the coolest, the wordsmith who's better than anyone else, all of that is the toughest thing to overcome. I teach my students that the greatest strength of a professional negotiator is to not know. Because the truth is, we don't know what they're going to do. People do the craziest things. I have no idea what they're going to do. I have no idea what your audience is going to do with what we're talking about. I really don't. All I can say is, say no to it and move on.
What happens when a CAMP-trained negotiator makes a mistake? How do you handle that?
They just go back and say, look, I just really screwed this up. I'm falling short here. It's my fault, not yours. Let me start again. I really dropped the ball here because, remember, we're driven by mission and purpose. and mission and purpose is written in the adversary's world to their benefit with no money or power to us. Notice I said my purpose is to help the world become more effective in its decision making. No money or power to me.
Can you go over the difference between, and you're probably relating to that right now with mission and purpose, but what's the difference between a goal and an objective, and why is that important?
Oh, it's terribly important. See, so many people are misled by goal, and the word goal is so misused. It's a terrible failing. Goal, by definition in Webster's Dictionary, is an action to an end that is manageable. So now think about that a moment. So now you really do some soul searching, and you ask yourself, what can we manage? Now, to manage, we look that word up, and well, what does manage mean? Well, it means to control, to stop and start at will. Well, what can we control in this life? And people really struggle with this, but eventually they discover they can only manage through habit, their activity, what they do with time, and their behavior. And how they behave. And that takes a great deal of to overcome and build the proper habits. But that's a goal. And that's the only goal we should ever set, is our activity and our behavior. Now, an objective, by Webster's Dictionary definition, is something that once achieved can be used again and again to forward our long-term aim, which is our mission and purpose. An objective is also a building block to plan, which I'll talk about in a moment. But remember, I said it's something we can use over and over again. So the activity of taking notes. At the end, when it's finished, and we've taken great notes, we've also accomplished an objective. We have a record of what was said. Now we can use that record to go back to formulate our plans for the future. That those notes help us build a plan. To go out and purchase a computer, the driving of the car is an activity. The asking of questions is a behavior about the computer. So we set a goal to ask the right questions, go drive to get the computer. Now, once we own the computer, we've accomplished an objective. And the computer is going to fit into our plan. Now, the plan must always be designed to solve the real problem. So, based on our mission and purpose, we set goals and objectives and build plans that solve the real problem. Now, people are all over the map with goals, objectives. They never even think about mission and purpose. In fact, I venture to say, Mike, that in the audiences I've been in front of in the last 20 years in this business, the audiences back in the days when we were doing a lot of workshops, we had no choice. We had to do workshops. I would ask, okay, what is your mission? What's your purpose? And someone would say, well, it's my goal. Well, I want to make the deal. I want to sell this. I want to make this deal. I want to build this relationship. I want blah, blah. So they're all over the map. They really confuse their adversary because they don't really know what they really want. Or what they want is not attainable.
Can you tell me about your most exciting experience using the skills you've learned with negotiating? Maybe what is your most exciting and memorable negotiation, if you would call it that?
I've got a couple. One is a player where I'm actually doing the negotiation, and one is a coach where I'm coaching a negotiation. I think that probably the most exciting as a coach involved baby twin girls. And a very close client of mine, who was a client at the time, called me and said, we've had baby twin girls, they're premature. It looks like we're going to lose one daughter, and the other one has a real problem with her heart. Would you coach me on negotiating with the doctors in the hospital and the insurance company to be sure that she gets the absolute maximum best care? So I participated in that, and I didn't do much. But it was a very exciting negotiation for me that I was really helping a family. So I think that one stands out for me. And then on the other side, as a player, I was negotiating for the rights for the Nabisco brand's label for a product we wanted to offer in our fundraising company many years ago. I had attended Dr. Karras's seminar in Cincinnati.
Negotiating guy.
Right.
Okay.
And I called, I'd gone to their seminars, bought all their products, and came back.
Did you think it was great at the time?
I thought it was wonderful. I mean, it made perfect sense to me. Everybody's nice, right?
What was his philosophy?
Yeah, win-win.
Win-win, okay.
Yeah, and I, you know, everybody's nice, and everybody wants everybody to be happy and successful, and, right? And we're all going to be relationship builders and yada, yada. And I came back, and I was negotiating to use the label, the Nabisco brand's label, my little company for fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
And I called Dr. Karras and I asked him, I said, I would like you to coach me on negotiations. We're having an amazing negotiation for the trademark of Nabisco that we want to put on our product in the field and use it in our advertising. And here's what Dr. Karras said to me. He said, you want me to take responsibility for what we teach? And I said, well, yes, I'm happy to pay you. He said, I could never take responsibility for what we teach. I kind of sat back in my chair, and one of my board members was there when he told me this. It was a very distinguished man who happened to be one of the founders of the Limited Stores in Columbus, Ohio.
Right.
And he said to me as we hung up the phone, he said, Jim, you don't need that. Just go to Nabisco and create the vision of what you're trying to do, and they'll give you the trademark. You don't need coaching.
All right, so you went over. Did you fly over? Yeah.
I forgot my briefcase of my presentation.
You were going to present them facts.
I was going to give them all the facts and figures, and I didn't have anything. So I just said, well, I came over. Here's the question. How important is it that we distribute these cookies that were manufactured in your bakeries in Europe to the schools all over the United States? And they said, very. I said, well, I need your help. They said, well, what do you need us to do? I need the use of your trademark. Not a problem.
That was it. One question, told the
question,
truth.
Bingo.
And it cuts through all the shit, doesn't it?
And everybody said, and Mike, I got to tell you, everybody I talked about this said, there is no way Nabisco is going to give you their trademark to put out in the world.
So I've got consultants who want to be expert negotiators. You provide products and services. What would be your recommendation for them to really learn your system?
All they really have to do is step up to the plate and go to work. I mean, we have the teams. We have the coaches. We have the programs. We're doing it every day.
Tell me the purpose of the coach. Is it when you have students, is your philosophy for each student to have a coach?
We have two coaches for each student.
Tell me how that all works and where that philosophy came from.
Sure. Well, it's because it's a human performance event. I'm an old pilot, an old Vietnam era guy, and manipulating the controls of that airplane is a human performance event. And it takes decision making. And the whole area is decision making. And negotiation is nothing more than a human performance event. And over the years, we've developed a system that works every single time. You're always safe if you're within that system. It's the same thing in the airplane. And we know that for your consultants, Mike, I know this for a fact. For them to really develop a system and climb the mountain they'd like to climb, they're going to have to change their behaviors. And just like a fighter pilot has to change from driving a car to manipulating the controls of a jet, it's a whole different world. And we know they're going to have to fail safely so that they learn and own the system. So we assign an academic coach to support them while they fail academically, safely. Now, that doesn't mean they're failures. It just means that it's not going to be apparent to them early on.
What's an academic coach do?
An academic coach monitors all of their work in academics, helps them answer questions, rethink questions. For example, if I said to you, What is it meant by greatest strength is your greatest weakness? Emerson talks about your greatest strength is your greatest weakness. What does that mean?
So your academic coach helps you understand these concepts?
All the concepts, all the rules, all the principles. It takes about 18 hours of academic work online with a coach.
And you have all these academic philosophies laid out in your training?
Oh, absolutely. It's all laid out step by step.
And the coach, is that all online or by the phone? You pick up the phone and call?
It's almost all online, but you can talk back and forth online, or you can also pick up the phone. That just depends on the individual and what they require.
Okay, so you got an academic coach to help you understand the philosophies behind the system.
Right.
Okay.
And then you have...
And you've integrated all these great ideas from your research over the years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's all supported by extra reading.
Drucker and all that stuff.
We have links to all of it. Then we have a negotiations coach who actually immediately starts helping you prepare for a real negotiation.
Would you consider going in for one of these opportunity analysis, a potential client to sell your services or to get them to decide if they're a good match? That would be considered a negotiation, right?
Oh, absolutely. See, I think the appointment to go is a negotiation.
Right.
See, if you're invited, that's one thing. If you've tricked them into seeing you, that's another.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're leaving, look, Mike, give me just 10 minutes. Let me show you what I got.
That's a trick.
It's a tactic.
Right.
Nothing can be done in 10 minutes.
Right.
Or someone says to you on the phone, look, I'll give you 10 minutes. What do you say? Well, I can't do anything in 10 minutes. I don't want to waste your time.
That's skill.
So, you know, and it's principle, right?
I mean, right.
You know, why would you want to see me to begin with? I don't need any favors, right? I'm not going to say that, but I don't need them. So now the negotiation coach helps the participant with an actual negotiation. And it doesn't matter where they are in the world, our technology allows them to link with the coach in real time right at their desk. We have a complete system of negotiations management that we provide the client, and it's state of the art.
How many students have you trained in your camp?
9,000.
You got students from all over the world?
All over the world, in all languages, all continents, today.
How are you handling the language barrier?
Everything we do is in English.
Okay, got it.
And I'll tell you why. Because the rest of the world wants to negotiate in English. I've offered to, you know, the book is published, Start With No, and our new book, No, is being published in 9 languages. But everyone who approaches us wants to do it in English because they know that English is where the big opportunities lie. Now, we are going to do a Spanish-speaking version because we have Spanish-speaking coaches who are being demanded that they be capable of doing negotiations in Spanish. So that's the one area that we are going to branch out into very quickly. But right now, it's all English.
Take me through the process. Let's create some vision. Let's say we have a consultant or someone listening to this interview.
Yeah, let's talk about David because I talked with David.
Yeah, all right, let's talk about Dave Flannery. He's fanatical. He's an avid learner, and he's an animal.
Yeah, he's definitely focused. There's no questions. It was a pleasure to talk to him.
Okay, so he's interested in this.
So David would sign up. And he would receive his coaching assignments, 2 coaches, and they would call him on the telephone. They would talk him into the technology, show him how easy it is to use.
Do you need a high-speed computer or will it work regular
dial-up? It's a dial-up. It's both.
Okay.
It was designed for dial-up. And broadband makes it very fast.
Now, I see a lot of stuff on your about it being very secure. What about the security of the?
Well, the security is we our corporate clients pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to use this, and they require that their information be secure.
Mm-hmm.
We also have government contracts that require security. So
you have governments using this?
Yes. So what we do, so let's go back to David. So David will speak with his academic coach and his negotiations coach. He would be given his protocol. The first step, David would take our first simulation involving a very large negotiation. It would take about 45 minutes. David would complete that negotiation.
Is this simulation like video, presented video?
No, it's not. It's all digital.
So it's like a case study, right?
And it's a real case study, actually copied from one of our negotiations.
All right, so it's taken from an actual real negotiation, and David's playing the part of the negotiator.
That's right, the person approaching the negotiation.
Okay.
He'll take that negotiation, then he moves off, then he moves into the first lesson. He progresses through the first lesson, and during that progression, he goes back and retakes, as he's learning the tools of the system, he'll go back and retake the negotiation, the simulation, the first one.
How long does it take to go through the simulation?
Oh, 30 minutes.
Okay.
30 to 40 minutes, depending on the...
Then are you graded on that simulation?
Oh, yes.
So you're graded, then you see what you did wrong, learn from your mistakes, and then do it again.
Well, what we're going to do is you're graded, but we don't point out the mistakes. You just take your grade and go into study. Now, there's a reason for this. In a flight simulator, if you crash, you crash. You don't study the crash till you leave the simulator. So we want them to fail safely and feel comfortable failing. We'll go back and retake it after we've done some study. Now we go back in and start studying.
So is that study right within that first module?
That's right.
And how long does it take to study that?
That study will take about 3 hours.
Okay, 3 hours. And then
go back and retake. If the retake is really excellent, we move on to the second simulation. If it's not excellent, then the coach will go back to the simulation, back to the academics, talk about some concepts that were missed, and there'll be a third retake of the simulation.
So each one of these tests are well thought out, and it's a progressive learning?
Oh, absolutely.
Based on fundamentals.
That's right. Now, in the meanwhile, to David working with the academic instructor in the simulations and training, the actual negotiations coach is helping David prepare for a real negotiation.
In his consulting business?
And absolutely.
Okay, so he can use it with what he's doing, right?
Immediately. And the negotiations coach will help him establish his preparation for the next negotiation, even though he hasn't completed training. So because we want them having success, making money immediately. So now the academics continue until completion. It takes about 12 hours of academics total based on the client's schedule. But in the meanwhile, we're conducting real negotiations where we're practicing the skills learned in training. At the end of the period, now, our best clients stick with us for 1 year minimum. If they have a budget restraint, they work with us for at least 90 days, and that gets them going. Now, hopefully we have enough success in that 90 days, they can afford to stick with us for a year. And then we have clients that have been with us for 15 and 20 years. So,
and they stay with you.
And once they get used to coaching, they would not be without coaching. That's a hard thing for us to say because it's too self-serving, too much not believable.
Right. These simulations, how many are there in the training?
Five.
And these simulations would pertain to consultants, or it would pertain to anyone across the board to learn fundamentals?
Anyone trying to reach an agreement. The principles are the same.
Domestic or business?
Mike, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
No, it's just reaching an agreement between two or more parties.
Now, what about you've got some CD sets?
Yes, those are for people who have a real challenge financially. We're trying to get something in the hands of anyone who really, truly wants to try and get better but has a real financial problem.
The CDs, are you doing actual live trainings?
A live training with real clients, yes.
Are they audio or video?
Audio.
So you're saying those CDs, are you working with that? They're actual real negotiations?
They're real.
And you are allowed to record them and stuff?
Yeah, they're actual training sessions that we were allowed to record with the whole room full of real clients, real people, asking real questions. Real challenges.
How's the quality sound on these CDs? Were these recorded professionally in the room?
They recorded professionally, recorded digitally, and live.
In the CDs, is there a lot of Q&A with the audience in there?
It's all Q&A with the audience. There's very little studio time introducing the CDs.
Okay, great.
You have consultants out there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to read something to you.
Okay.
Here's what PhD Larry Chimeron said, former chairman and CEO of Chase, Econometrics, and the WEFA Group. You could have been writing about me and no. I found it very difficult to say no to clients throughout my consulting career. As a result, frequently took lower fees than I should have and took on added commitments using up huge amounts of time that I should have not given away. This is a must-read for all consultants and all other professional service providers who have been pressured into lower fees and or added freebies by their clients. Where was Jim Camp when I began my consulting career?
You know, there's an interview I did with a guy named Larry Steinmetz, and he does trainings all over the world on pricing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to sell at higher prices. And, I mean, there's some similarities, you know, and it keeps coming back to that damn confidence. The people who are too weak, who say yes to everything and don't have it in them to say no. You know, how it's just interesting how it all comes right back to you. But it
well, that confidence, Mike, comes from, I'll tell you where that confidence
comes from. Having a system, a tool, something you can rely on.
You got it. I promise you that every guy and gal who go to pilot training, who take a look at that jet and they say, you're going to eject, the first time they hear that, they go, I'm going to do what? They are scared to death. I was. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to jump out of this airplane at 35,000 feet. Are you crazy? You overcome that with exactly what you said. A system that works every time. As long as you're within that system, you're safe. And that system will tell you what to do next. It's absolutely the case.
You have a guarantee with the system?
Oh, sure, as long as they do the work. The only people that will fail are the ones that won't do the work.
At the end of our interview with Jim Camp, I hope you found this helpful.